Indy, over here.
Indiana Jones, at your service, Toad. Ah!
Indiana Jones and other action figures, new from Raiders of the Lost Ark Collection, each sold separately.
Searching my past for the things that I've seen. Is it my life or just something I dream?
Resume. Noun. 1. A summing up. Summary. 2. A brief written account of personal, educational, and professional qualifications and experience.
I remember going to the park and spinning the merry-go-round as fast as I could. I would then grab a rail and let it drag me along the ground, like when Indiana Jones trailed a truck down a desert road by the length of his bullwhip. I had a few of the Star Wars-sized figures from the local Jimco. Once I found an Indiana Jones doll partially open at a Toys R Us. It was missing his gun and maybe his whip and or hat, plus a price sticker. There were no barcode scanners in those days, so my mother wasn't sure we could buy it in that condition. I cried until a sympathetic stock girl made up a price. $6, $9, and she pegged it with her gun. On her own, my mother ended up buying me a Ken doll and a couple of Barbies. But not all at once, so that Indy would have other dolls in his size range to play with. I eventually got a new Gene Simmons Demon Kiss doll secondhand, so he was the obvious villain. My grandmother worried that there might be something wrong with my having all those Barbie dolls. She consulted her doctor. He told her that since I had boy and girl dolls, it might actually be good for developing social interaction skills. He was probably right, since I've never had any feelings of confusion regarding my gender or sexuality, and despite my internet reputation, tend to get along with others in real life. Anyway, my stepfather was less secure and gave all the dolls away behind my back. In another instance of malingering topics, I already talked about Raiders of the Lost Ark in episodes number 0 and number 2, only to find I still had more to say previously on the blog. So forgive the belaboring, but I'll take advantage of the further adventures of Indiana Jones to cover anything previously missed. The first issue I recall buying was July 1983's number 10, with a Howard Chaykin cover and a story by Archie Goodwin and David McElhinney. I confess that Michelinie was never my back. I don't blame him here, though, because Indiana Jones' charisma and the kinetic energy of Spielberg's action sequences never seemed to translate to comics. The interior art was credited to Dan Reed, but like most anything he inked, it looked like a Danny Bolandi book. For whatever reason, I was drawn to books by Bolandi in this time period, and he had an overwhelming impact as an embellisher along the lines of a Bob McLeod, where he was all but the full artist on the title he was inking. I find it odd that we're still talking about guys like Leighton and Rubenstein without ever seeming to bring up Bolandi's unsung talent. I suspect he must be one of those guys people quietly hate, as opposed to the vocal animosity directed at Vince Coletta, but I dug him. The issue's tale involved Indy battling displaced South American tribesmen on New York skyscrapers before traveling to their turf to confront Ernst Toth's surprisingly attractive Aryan sister. It was also unexpectedly violent, and Indy showed a lot of ingenuity against various perils. I don't know why it took me this long to get an issue, as I have vague possible memories of seeing earlier ones. I find it hard to believe that I'd pass up comics drawn by Chaykin, John Byrne, or Cary Gamble, a number of which I'd catch as back issues before the 80s ended. You've got to admit, Indy initially had a much better looking book than Star Wars. But based on its lack of longevity, archaeology didn't seem to translate to comics as well as space opera. I also have to admit that I didn't buy any new issues after this point, probably because in its second year it became a dumping ground for unfashionable Silver Age artists like Herb Trimpe, Steve Ditko, and Larry Lieber, and it didn't quite make a third year. Also in the 30s, nostalgia tip, from one of my best friend's grocery sack of comics came Blackhawk number 263 by Mark Evanier and Dan Spiegel. I didn't get to read The Last Crusade of Femme Fatale Domino's extremely prominent and barely covered breasts until I could better appreciate them in 1988. I came in too late to get the full What If experience, since the book would be canceled a few issues after number 41, which I pulled off the Jimco spinner rack. I have to assume the dynamic and boldly colored cover by Michael Golden was a big selling point, as well as the skullduggery within. The story by Alan Zelenitz was appropriately violent and grim, abetted by Conan artist Mark Silvestri and inker Mel Candido. I kind of liked the Submariner, but his underwater world of blue barbarians struck me as kind of ponderous and a bit silly when pure uncut Conan was on the shelf right next to it. Finishing out July, I should mention that at least one issue of the Star Wars Return of the Jedi Marvel Comics adaptation got purchased. Return was a superior viewing experience for me as a kid, and had me waving an imaginary lightsaber out the car window on the drive home. I'd seen all three of the movies at the cinema, the first at a drive-in, and at the time Return replaced Raiders as my favorite film, until being unseated by Aliens in 1986. The comic had reliably detailed and moody art by Al Williamson and a Bill Sienkiewicz cover, but I barely remember anything about the one issue I bought, or even which issue it was. Remember when this show went on a 2-year hiatus, dropped one episode, and took another year off? That was down to my going nuts trying to cover my TV and movie watching in 1982 with mind-numbing and scattershot audio I never wanted to hear again, much less edit. Still, I'd like to try to touch on a bit of the broader culture I was exposed to. So we'll dip into some movies I saw theatrically in the summer of 1983 and see how that goes. My Tutor and Still Smokin' came out earlier in the year, but I saw them at the drive-in on double bills, so they were probably not fresh at that point. Likewise, my viewing of Space Hunter, Adventures in the Forbidden Zone was not 3D-enabled at the Dollar Show months after initial release. I have to tell you, it was no Ice Pirates. I remember nothing about this except that a young Molly Ringwald was extremely whiny in it. Later that year, I saw Space Raiders, to barely more lasting effect. Nearly 4 decades later, of the three, scenes of Steve Martin and Kathleen Turner from The Man with Two Brains come more readily to mind. In a change from the usual Dollar Show, we made a point of seeing the latest Bond movie at a fancy mall theater. Just as I won't call that movie by name on an all-ages show, I can't say much about Porky's 2 the next day. Of the two, the latter made the stronger impression, as I rewatched and quoted it for the rest of the decade. Boogie, 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 boogie. Boogie, 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 boogie. I don't know if it was the zeitgeist or maybe my grandmother was quietly a Burt Reynolds fan, but we caught Stroker Ace theatrically. I didn't feel compelled to revisit that one, but I will recommend the Lovage song that cheekily borrowed the title. Come to think of it, just buy the entire album, Music to Make Love to Your Old Lady By, and thank me later. I know for a fact that I got Amazing Spider-Man number 246 from a 3-pack, rather than the August ship date, since I'd have never bought a J. Jonah Jameson spotlight on purpose. The story by Roger Stern was a collection of supporting character daydream sequences, which was nice enough if you care about the inner lives of Mary Jane Watson and Felicia Hardy, but the real draw was the art of John Romita Jr. and Daniel Green. I think the Avengers number 237 was also in that pack, because that was another issue I doubt I would have bought as a single, and only remember reading it once or twice in the same brief time period. It was by Roger Stern, Al Milgrom, and Joe Sinnott, featuring a modest, Masters of Evil-type villainous collective with too many Spider-Man-specific villains that gave me an inflated sense of the importance of Moonstone and especially Blackout in the Marvel Universe. That dude is best known, to the degree he's known at all, as the loser of a Who Wore It Best matchup with DC's Bolt. In those pre-royalty days, the big team books always had perfunctory art and were overcrowded with mild characters and largely stakes-free battles. This issue was an example of that. Just to prove what an OG I am, you have to know I bought Marvel Tales starring Peter Porker, the Spectacular Spider-Ham number 1, fresh off the 7-Eleven newsstand. It was an oddball, funny, super animal one-shot parodying two of my then-favorite heroes and the Hulk. It must have done okay, since an ongoing series arrived a few years later. The lead story was by Thomas P. DeFalco, Mark Armstrong, and Jose R. Albedo. It was cute and action-packed with interesting art and pointed out glaring flaws in the canon Spider-Man and Captain America stories. Seriously, how did we ever buy Steve Rogers walking around with his shield hanging off his shoulders in case of emergency, but somehow concealed under a jacket? The Ghost Rider backup by Stephen Miller struck me as weird and sort of gross, but the whole package was neat overall. Really pulled off a low-key alternative quality, and I managed to hang on to my original copy for years. It recently came out as a True Believers dollar reprint thanks to Into the Spider-Verse, and I snatched that up. Keebler Company presents DC's The New Teen Titans was a dollar comic when that was a premium price, so I didn't mind as much buying that one from a resale shop ghetto grab bag. Per Mike's Amazing World of Comics, this was the last of the Titans Drug Awareness books released, though I got two of the three in the same bag. This was also the best of the lot, with George Perez's first pass at a Pieta by way of John Byrne homage cover, and interiors by himself and Dick Giordano. Aside from replacing the licensing-restricted Robin with the prefab protector stand-in, this felt like a legitimate period Titan story more than a PSA. That said, Marv Wolfman had a repeating motif of taking a page to allow a drug-addled teenager to relay their harrowing stories as interstitials, like the better examples of televised service messages of the time. I especially loved the after-school special moment where teen hero and recovering heroin addict Speedy took over one of those interstitials. The teens were so emotive in this melodrama that I honestly think this comic and the whole just say no effort contributed to my being relatively straight edge for most of my childhood. Though I very occasionally tried marijuana, it was always a rare one-off that I haven't touched in probably a couple of decades now. I never even attempted anything harder, although I reserve the right to dip into some shrooms once I get to retirement age. Point being, for me at least, Nancy Reagan got something right. Also, George Perez really put Speedy over, and his key role in the drug issues made Roy one of my favorite Titans. I bought Krull number 1 by David Michelinie, Brett Blevins, and Vince Coletta because I dug the photo cover and thought the movie might be interesting. They squeezed the entire adaptation into 2 issues, so it was a somewhat dense read, yet still managed to be dull as dishwater. I think I tried to watch the movie once or twice, but I either never finished or tuned it out while watching. All I remember are foggy swamp trees and that claw boomerang thing. Hawkeye number 4 was the last issue of the fun Archer solo miniseries by Mark Gruenwald with embellishing by the Danny Bolandi, my boy. In the story, Hawkeye beats a pretty girl nearly to death while going deaf. Jade's a black cat and Peter Parker number 76. Younger me seemed to enjoy violence against women, if only for the heightened drama. This was obviously a repurposed Green Arrow story, given that sonic emissions are what tore up Clint Barton's eardrums, and Mockingbird was always a Black Canary ripoff, but I didn't know that then. I just thought the villains were cool looking, the book was darn violent, and ended with the heroes newly married and nude in a bubble bath. I kept thinking it was some kind of dream, hoax, imaginary story, but Hawkeye continued to use a hearing aid while shacked up for years thereafter. It felt to this young reader like a comic book that mattered. Viva la continuity! Anybody remember the Steve Gutenberg Invisible Man riff, The Man Who Wasn't There? If it wasn't for a shot of a silver ball filled with vials of blue fluid that affected his change in the trailer, I would have never realized that I saw this theatrically. On the other hand, Easy Money at the Dollar Show really stuck with me. I've had a lifelong crush on Jennifer Jason Leigh, and my lower class upbringing caused me to gravitate toward louts like Rodney Dangerfield and Joe Pesci. Unflattering as the portrayal may have been, the movie also had rare prominent Latino representation. Anthrax fans should know the chorus of I'm the Man sample dialogue from Taylor Negron's Julio character. You've also got Jeffrey Jones auditioning his iconic 80s scumbag persona before he knew maybe it wasn't an act. Another huge movie for me was Ralph Bakshi's animated Fire and Water, but I'd need a whole podcast to properly cover that one. Oh, we're gonna rock on to Electric Avenue, and then we'll take it higher. September only offered Daredevil number 202, involving a dumber, more volatile, and shorter-lived riff on Vandal Savage. It was by Denny O'Neil, William Johnson, and once again, Danny Bolandi. There was also a goofy Assistant Editor's Month backup with crude childlike drawings of intentionally poorly identified Daredevil villains by Luke McDonald, which sent me into a Proustian reverie when I was looking at it recently. It wasn't a great issue, but I found the characters interesting and would be back again. It was a dry spell for movies, too.
The post.
October's Peter Parker, The Spectacular Spider-Man number 86 was an experiment involving comedy artist Fred Hembeck helping to draw a relatively serious story alongside the regular creative team with lots of fourth wall breaking behind the scenes production stuff. I'd like to see how it reads as an adult, but as a kid, it left no great impression. What did was my friend's copy of Uncanny X-Men number 177, because I feared for my girlfriend, Kitty Pryde, apparently slain by Mystique. This was the issue advertised on that cookie crisp cereal giveaway I mentioned on a previous episode, and since I'd read it already, I went with the Spider-Man comic instead. Looking at the landscape of November 1983, I feel I have some explaining to do. I hadn't continued with Captain America because of a combination of falling out of habit and Mike Zeck being replaced by a string of inferior artists. Friends of mine were buying Uncanny X-Men and Power Man and Iron Fist, so I just mooched off them. My local newsstand did not carry New Teen Titans, or it sold out before I could get any, so I was simply out of luck there. That's why I was always questing for the next new series, rather than sticking with favorites. For example, I bought Storm and Ilyana Magic number 3. I don't think I'd quite grasped the concept of a miniseries yet. I was used to jumping into an ongoing series at a random point and chancing a cliffhanger, but these circumstances guaranteed it. Further, this was an alternate fantasy universe parallel timeline version of the already Byzantine Claremont X-Men and the New Mutants, the latter unfamiliar to me. I pretty much didn't know what the hell was going on, or to whom, and who made my poor Kitty Pryde into an evil werecat. Tom Palmer did such a swell job inking over Ron Frenz that my mind recalls it as a John Buscema issue, but the story battered my young, wet brain inside of its soft skull. I was still chicken enough to be too freaked out by the heavy metal Satanism on the cover to even consider buying number 4. I thought Green Lantern and Hal Jordan was one of the best-looking superheroes around, which is why I bought his superpowers figure. I likely also knew him from animation, but probably not all that well. The appeal was mostly in his uncommon brown hair, sleek costume, the boss oath, and the smart accessory. I think I also liked the design of the throwaway villain Javelin, with his severe hair and the balance of gold and blue in his suit. Look, I'm just gonna say it. Booster Gold stole his look when he was making off with the time bubble and wishes he'd rocked it as well. Javelin's a cool name and unique weapon, at least until you start thinking about it. See, the guy had a bunch of collapsible trick javelins that he carried in pouches, sort of like Green Arrow, except he would logically have less of a selection and lacked the propulsion device to throw as far as a bow could shoot. It might have been cool if he was a gymnast who used a tricked out javelin to pole vault, or doubled as a staff pugil stick, but even then he would only be fit to fight guys like the aforementioned Green Arrow. Instead, he could fly and throw pointy sticks at a guy who patrolled the galaxy with a ring that created anything he could imagine. Javelin was equivalent to a Firestorm villain in punching out of his weight class. And like the mighty hemp rope of Slipknot, he survived only through a loophole, the color yellow. I suppose the cover of Green Lantern number 173 should have clued me in, but the issue ended with a javelin exploding on Green Lantern, covering him with yellow paint and rendering him powerless. I'm not sure Hal's weakness had come up in my reading before, so as I was watching him falling out of the sky to his probable death, I was thinking, this dude sucks. Not concerned for his well-being or angst at the cliffhanger, but more like, these guys are so, so lame. This issue was likely my introduction to Bruce, Eclipso Gordon, and the Monitor. But all I took away from it was yellow paint? Really? In my eyes, Hal Jordan never recovered from this indignity. I want to say The Thing number 9 was another 3-pack purchase, but I have an odd association between it and a rarely visited Circle K in the exact opposite direction from my apartment as my standby 7-Eleven. So who knows? Maybe it's because the book felt so off-brand. Joe Sinnott's inks gave Ron Wilson's art an old-timey look, and The Thing transformed into some sort of centurion battling cops. It was a very Weisinger Superman sort of turn. This stood in sharp contrast to Alicia Masters' disturbingly butch haircut, a very big turnoff even in pre-adolescence. I recall the book's splash page headshot giving way to a 2-page spread, which registered in my brain as a waste of 3-story pages. Blame John Byrne, ever fond of shortcuts and spectacle for its own sake. As best as I can tell, the family avoided the movieplex until the unfashionable pirate flick Nathan Hayes, and my mother definitely had a thing for Tommy Lee Jones, who should wear a beard more often.
But now that I've come to see the light, all I want to do is make things right. So just say the word and tell me that I'm forgiven.
December was something of a turning point month for me as a collector. See, I remember wanting to buy G.I. Joe, Real American Hero number 21, since Snake Eyes was the shizzle. But I didn't because a friend was already collecting that book. However, I don't think he ever bought that issue. He did get Uncanny X-Men number 179, where my girlfriend Kitty Pryde was being forced to wed a hideous Morlock, but only got to toss through his copy. I would eventually own all three issues of Marvel's The A-Team miniseries, which was as terrible as they sound, but not for some months, thanks to another dollar store handmade three-pack. This was clearly not as rewarding as owning the G.I. Joe or X-Men issues would have been. I bought Hercules, Prince of Power number 1, probably due to some misplaced loyalty, after having seen the badly dubbed Lou Ferrigno, Sybil Danning Italian film at the theater earlier that year. The comic was better than the movie, and I did enjoy that crisp Bob Layton art, but I was not prepared for the hilarious gender confusion related to Herc romancing a disguised male Skrull masquerading as a human woman. That sure aged badly. Also, it was a sequel to an earlier miniseries, so I was annoyed by cornball supporting characters like Recorder and the unanticipated future setting. In fact, subsequent reading in comics and myth made me come to really dislike Hercules in every way, so much that I enjoy Wonder Woman kicking his sorry butt more than is probably appropriate. I got Peter Parker, the Spectacular Spider-Man number 88, on whose cover Mr. Hyde prepared to tear Black Cat in two. I swear to you, I never tortured animals or set things on fire, so I cannot explain my fixation on evil done to Felicia Hardy. Today I just chalk it up to an irrational hatred of analogs, which would also get me off the hook on the Battery of Mockingbird. All this is to say I never cared much for Hyde or his unlikely partner Cobra, so the contents of the actual issue escaped me. Not enough cleavage and bloodletting, clearly. In case you're wondering, yes, I sure do seem to be buying a lot more Spidey comics than Captain America ones. No, my shame. I'm going to let Nathaniel Dusk, Private Investigator number 1, in as a squeaker, if only to represent for DC. I bought a water-damaged copy of this off a spinner rack at a flea market in the mid-80s. That bends the rules of this project, but I feel there are enough essential keywords in that last sentence to allow for it. This was a moody period number by Don McGregor and Gene Colan, harmed by the funky coloring as DC worked out the process of their upscale printing. I doubt it was revelatory to anyone familiar with Mickey Spillane, but his casual domestic violence was jarring to me as a kid, and I still feel a little regret over never seeking out the entire miniseries, though I did score number 2 out of a quarter bin. One last note on comics, even though I didn't fish them out of the quarter bin until 1989, I feel like I'd be remiss in not pointing out that I put together a run of post-Mike Rowe Star Slayer beginning with his last specific issue before jumping to the John Ostrander, Lennon Del Sol issues with number 9 through number 18. I had previously tried an issue of Grimjack out of the quarter bin that I would later realize from annual reader polls in the letter columns was one of the single most hated issues of the series. Thankfully, the story of a temporally displaced space pirate interested me enough to try more of his issues, which introduced me to the art of Timothy Truman and superior Grimjack backup strips from which his solo series had spun off. When the quarter bin stock dried up, I was comfortable abandoning Star Slayer, but I started paying cover price for Grimjack back issues. I more or less have a complete run today, totaling nearly 100 issues between graphic novels, miniseries, and its own spinoffs, even accounting for dollar show delayed viewings. December was a big month for movies. I'm pretty sure we saw a re-release of the Disney Mouse duo The Rescuers at a regular theater off 45, and I know my stepfather wouldn't have waited to see Dirty Harry in Sudden Impact. I've always had a thing for Sandra Locke, and despite dipping into Grindhouse territory, I still think this is one of Clint Eastwood's better action vehicles. Now, Silkwood probably kept until the dollar cinema, and I'm sure an unscrupulous industry exposing a whistleblower to radiation before a mysterious demise impacted on my psyche in ways still felt in my views today. It took me years to consciously recognize that I was a Meryl Streep fan, because I didn't even realize the same person from Kramer vs. Kramer was in this movie. DC Cab is like the definition of dollar fare. But I was already sold on Mr. T from the A-Team, and I was even into Adam Baldwin after seeing My Bodyguard at the drive-in. Look, this is a very dumb and not particularly funny Joel Schumacher paycheck gig, but this thing is packed with people you would have loved growing up in the 70s and 80s. Gary Busey, Paul Rodriguez, the Barbarian Brothers, Wojo from Barney Miller, Noogie from Miami Vice, Bill Maher from When You Could Still Stand Him, Jill Sholin making me gaga at a formative age. Irene Carey even does the closing theme song and cameos. It was exactly the sort of lazy Sunday junk food I wanted back in the day. And speaking of Gary Busey, I should probably explain my voice. I've been a hard-traveling zero for the last couple of months. And I think I got that Dos Equis virus. So I've been coughing up crud for weeks. I've poured myself some vodka, and I've just tried to power through this podcast. I've actually been doing a fair amount of recording over the last couple of weeks, so you're probably going to have months of me sounding like crud on other podcasts. And I think I'm channeling my inner Gary Busey, my inner Texan, and trying to project so you can hear me without sounding as weak as my voice actually is when I'm trying to talk in my workplace. In fact, I'm doing so many recordings that I couldn't get the energy to actually edit anything, and that's why you're listening to a pretty much single read-through comic reader resume shouted into a microphone with my hoarse Jack Dib voice, because it's about the only thing I could get done. And thankfully, I'd already set it up, like literally everything was done on this thing weeks ago, just in case I screwed up like I did this week. I already had the album art, I already had all the social media gathered, I basically delivered it to myself this week with a bow on top, and God bless me for doing so. And God bless you for suffering through my voice. Hopefully I'll be back to normal and quit talking in this Kentucky Fried manner by the next time you hear one of these episodes. And I got a whole list of people to apologize to as well. Adriano, Dr. Ange, Between the Pages, Billy at Excelsior 73, Charlton Hero, Chris at Bad Books for Beginners, Chris Motito, Coffee and Comics, Collected Edition, Doc Strange, Ed Moore, Firestorm Fan, Giancarlo Nurko, History of Comics on Film, Paul Hicks, Iowa's Joe Crawford, Jeffrey Brown, Jennifer DeRoss, Keith G. Baker, Kenny Crayley Jr., Kirk Spencer 2020 Needs Your Vote in Vegas, Christados, The Liquid Awesome, Lisa Franklin, Lawrence Ginkizart, Myrna Loy, Nexus of All, Odell Amner Dracula, Rad Adventures Podcasting Network, Richard G., Roger Preeb, Ruben Araujo Jr., Ryan Daly, Slangward Scott, Sphinx Magoo, Superbound, Tim Price the Pod Crasher, Tom Beach, Wonder Woman Warrior for Peace Podcast, Xenozoic Xenophiles, and Doug Zawisha. Tom Bad Guy said, "Great stuff, I like it, totally following." Odell Abner Dracula wrote, "Somewhere in a remote storage, I have that Titans Annual signed by George Perez." Firestorm Fan, the Irredeemable Shag said, "Not Diablo Frank talking about DC Sampler. Flashbacks, the horror, still loving these comic resume postings." And finally, Super Duper Toy Box said, "Fun post. I like the Creature Commandos with G.I. Robot. New to me. Yes, it sounds depressing, doesn't it? Probably great, though."
Searching my mind for some truth to reveal. What thoughts are fantasy, what memories?